Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Tell Dem, a podcast hosted by The Masher in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse, generously funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation.
This series, we're shifting things around a bit, bringing you bold and unfiltered discussions around decolonising theatre.
Every episode, we'll be joined by amazing theatre makers from the global majority, discussing power structures, global influences,
what they do, how they do it, why they do it.
We're your hosts, Githika
and Beth,
and you are tuning into episode number 7.
This podcast contains themes that listeners may find disturbing, triggering, or uncomfortable.
Hello.
Hey.
Welcome back to Tell Dem. This is Series 3, Episode 7. And today we have a brilliant conversation lined up with Gail Babb.
And Samina Hossain.
Yes, and Samina Hossain. And what do we chat about?
So we get into some really deep and depthy conversations right from the start. We dive into a conversation around that word that we've talked about quite a lot, the decolonized word, and we ask them what that looks and feels like to them and how that feels different to the current state of the industry.
Yeah, and they're very different but interconnected response to that word as a launchpad for a conversation about how they would reimagine, like a radical reimagining of the structure of a theatre and the structure of the industry.
We also chat about building teams. All of us talk about how we build teams, how we find collaborators. And then we talk a little bit more about what it's like to be somebody in the regions making work.
And also the perspective of a Londoner, because Gail lives in London, and what it means for them to go outside of London into the regions to make work. That perspective is really interesting.
And then we finish up on a nice conversation about imagining what the next decade of theatre would look like and should evolve into. So stay tuned, it's a juicy one. Welcome to episode 7, series 3 of Tell Dem. And we've got some really exciting guests in the studio today, all of who are in the room with us. Hi.
Hello. Hiya.
So we've got two really special guests with us. We've got Gail Babb and we also have Samina Hossain. We're going to kick off with some bios for these two. So Beth, do you want to start with Gail's?
So Gail Babb is an award-winning dramaturg and director and was the participation producer at Tallawah for 11 years, helping countless black artists, technicians and producers to take their first steps into the industry, and a staggering 60% of whom are now sustaining creative careers, which is
incredible.
That's such an amazing stat. Gail runs the Applied Theatre MA at Goldsmiths Uni, and some of their directing credits include Stars by Mojisola Adebayo, who was on... Was it episode...
Episode five.
The Body Remembers, which was co-created with Heather Adjipong, and Run It Back, which started with Tipped and then was produced by Tallawah.
And then we've got Samina Hossain, repping it for Yorkshire. Whoop, whoop. We've got Samina Hossain, who is a freelance theatre director based in West Yorkshire. She is the associate director at Leeds Playhouse, and she's worked with various theatres, arts organisations and communities over the years. Her work is rooted in community and connection, and it's always been about getting to know people and endeavouring to remove barriers, both invisible and visible, which prevent them from engaging with theatre. Samina is passionate about making theatre a safe and brave space, enabling dialogue and connection. Some of her recent directing credits include Peanut Butter and Blueberries, and also A Christmas Carol by Deborah McAndrew at Whole Truck, and I Wanna Be Yours by Zia Ahmed at Leeds Playhouse.
Beautiful. Wow. Amazing. Lovely list of credits there. So we're going to start with question number one, which we ask everybody every episode, which is, what inspired you this week or in your recent life? Whoever wants to kick us off.
This week I was inspired. I'm in a community choir and we had a really good session on Monday. Just singing, a big group of us, variety of ages and walks of life, and people coming together to breathe together, sing together, singing harmony, clash, get it wrong, and find a way to get through. So yeah, I had a really good and inspiring Monday night with them.
Very cool.
So nice. Mine's also choir related.
Yeah.
Have a rant. On Tuesday evening, I went to see my 7-year-old niece perform. It's called Voices Together, and it's where schools come together and they sing. And she is like, she has an amazing voice, but her confidence when it comes to performance is so, like, she just doesn't handle it well. So for her to perform at Victoria Theatre in Halifax to a packed crowd, and I was just really like both proud of her, but then also her siblings who were like absolutely rooting for her, which was just gorgeous. Aww. And having to sit through, you know, 3 hours of watching hundreds of children perform, but you're just waiting for one, you're just waiting for your baby sister to perform. But these teenagers and her younger sister were just, and I was just like, ah, this is so lovely. So I felt very, just was buzzing from that.
Yeah, that is super nice.
How about you?
How about me? Do you know what? I got my hair done for the first time in like a year. Just got it cut this week in Manchester at a salon in Eccles, right? And it is full of the most amazing women. I feel really empowered every time I go in. The conversation is lit. And it's just really nice to be around women of all different ages, all different races, just talking about stuff that makes them happy or gossiping. And like, I wasn't part of the conversation, but I was just kind of there experiencing it all. And it felt like a show. I was just like listening and experiencing the smells and the sounds.
I love that. I always think like hairdressers know everything. They know everything that's going on in their local community because what they hear is amazing. So for me, I am inspired by watching Little Sims and her set at Glastonbury. I wasn't there physically, sadly, but I watched it on TV. And I also, the choreography by Chloe Dean, who is just an amazing choreographer, but also movement director in theatre, and their partnership. I just found it really, really inspiring. And seeing Little Sims sort of up on that stage, owning it, was also amazing.
Great. So the first question is a bit of a radical imagining question. The question is, what does a decolonised theatre look and feel like to you? And how does it differ from the current state of the industry? And we flung that word about quite a bit, decolonised, across all of the episodes, and we've really unpacked like what decolonising, decolonised means for different people, different artists. So it's kind of a two-loaded question because you guys might have different definitions in your head. You also might say, that's preposterous, I don't want to answer that because that feels ridiculous. That's also mine too. But I'm just going to ask that question one more time and then I'm going to be quiet and someone's going to say something. So what does a decolonised theatre look and feel like to you? And how does it differ from the current state of the industry?
So I'm not a massive fan of the word decolonising. Because that's not to critique any of the schools of decolonial thought that I think have, you know, pushed us ahead in many, many different ways. But I just don't think it's possible to decolonise colonial institutions or systems. I think the approach, the values, the mechanics, the violence of colonialism is embedded into it. And so actually, if you're going to strip them out, then suddenly the system is it is no longer what it was. So I think we have to build something different, which I'm really happy to radically imagine and to chat about and to, with the four of us.
Yeah.
But yeah, just to say that begin.
Yeah. I would say for me, like, even though I've been trying to like navigate decolonisation for a number of years now, if not longer, both in terms of the industry and just personal life, and I'm still at the tip of the ice, but like, I don't think it's similar, Gail, but I think like, I don't know how it's possible. I can't imagine, like, I think we're so rooted in, it's so rooted in how I've been, not even brought up, but how the environment that we're in, the way that we learn, the way that we engage. So I think I find it, not that saying that I disagree with that ambition or that hope. Oh my gosh, I would absolutely love that to happen, but I get stuck. Mm-hmm. I get stuck when I'm like, what does that? I'm like, oh, that means I would have to, I'd have to not be me on a personal level. And then when I get, when that grows, I'm like, okay, even my like really good allies, friends, people who I lean on would not have to be who they are. So for me, that's a distraction. But the second half of that question is interesting. And actually, how would I want the industry to be different? And I think there are, to be an artist where that heaviness doesn't exist, that weight, like, I don't know. I'd love to know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. And I think for the next generation of artists or coming through going, actually, just recently, maybe a few weeks ago, sorry, slight tangent, but I was doing some work in an... doing an anti-racist workshop, and there was this one exercise that took place, and which was great at first. It was like, oh, this is really fun. It was about you got to bargain privileges. So, like, you started imagining going, actually, what would it be like if the NHS didn't treat you differently, or if your children got to see their role models? I was like, oh, this is so cool. And then the exercise finished, and I was fine during the exercise, but when the exercise finished, I was like, oh my gosh, for so many of you in this room, that those privileges are yours. And that was really I was like, and I'd never seen a list like that. I'd never, even though I'm totally aware of those things. And so I think it's that as well. I think organisations to not hold global majority artists and audiences responsible for their own stuff that they need to deal with. For us to be, like, also get to be basic. And it's like we never get to just try and fail. I don't know, like, I just think that would be, sorry, I'm completely, like, not fully answering, but there's just so many of these little things of going, actually, get to be, and also for organisations to be transparent, especially when it comes around race and people trying to restore some relationships and, like, make up for historical damage that's done. Often it's very performative. So many different rambling thoughts.
Great, though. This is probably tangential, but because it's not actually what I was thinking, but just off the back of what you were saying, because I do anti-racist sort of training and consultancy as well, is that the first thing that comes to my mind is, why are you in that room? Actually, if we're trying to anti-racist ourselves as a system, as an institution, as organisations, I don't know why we always put, without thinking, non-white makers, workers in those rooms, because what are you learning? And yes, it's interesting to switch privileges and to think about it, but actually the cost of that learning is with you. And then how does that consultant, how does that trainer hold Black, Asian people in that space, and the pain that we're re-experiencing while we all chat about anti-racist practice as an abstract concept, while also then handling the guilt and the shame and the desire to change that might come out with our white colleagues. And I just feel like the burden is on us if we're in that space, and if we're really truly going to sort of attack the racist structures that we're working in, through and under, then we need to think about who and how we're doing that, who we're doing that for, who we're doing that with. But yeah, I guess the things I've been thinking about in terms of attempts at decolonisation are about makers, so artists, practitioners, technicians, all of us who are freelance in the industry. And I guess I'm thinking about two things that might, one that might enable us to be mediocre, to be basic, to risk, to fail, as well as to be excellent, which is just, I think, unquestionable. We just are the vast majority of the time. And one is salary. One is actually what happens when you take that precarity away from us. What happens if we're all in universal basic income, if there's an artist salary, if there's a technician salary, which means we might be on a more equal level in terms of power structure and about ability to say yes and to say no as the people who are salaried in our industry. I also think we need to be much clearer and much more transparent about how you get into the industry. How do you move from participant to practitioner? How do you move out of emerging or early career to established? How do you become a director without endless assistanting? What is assistanting? What does mentorship look like? All of those sorts of things. And then the other thing that I'm thinking about a lot is venues. And how do we open them up as well? How do we have a wider range of stakeholders and decision makers in charge of those spaces. In charge of those spaces? I don't like that as a phrase, but how do we have a wider range of people? And I mean both in terms of ethnicity and age and disability and gender and all of those sorts of things, but I also just mean a larger number of people. Mm-hmm. Is one person running a venue really the way that we do this?
Yeah.
What happens if that venue is community-led? And how do we get away of this idea when we're thinking about spaces that the artists that get to be in the space are because one person or a team of people have programmed them, and the communities get to be in the space if they are invited in? So what does it mean to bring a community into a space? What does it mean to go out into a community and take the art there? And I would just say that we need to really attack that language and attack the positionality that we are adopting, possibly without knowing, when we say that. Because if you're going into a community or you're bringing the community in, then you're not a part of the community.
Yeah.
And if you're not a part of the community, then who are you and what are you doing there?
Yeah, true.
And I just do need to give a shout out to Corey Campbell at Belgrade for reminding me of that.
Mm. I was actually, that was going to be my question of, like, are there examples of places that are maybe not perfectly, but starting to do this work that you think, for example, the Belgrade and Corey? Mm.
I think Commonwealth are another organisation which I feel like are part of the community. Mm. And I remember when they spent a lot of time actually being that, going actually not parachuting in, not, you know, going to save, like the saviour complex within participation work. I can't do with it, man. But their practice, I think, is incredible, and the work that they do, and also the art that comes from that as well, you know, is incredible. And you can see it. That's because they are part of the community, on both on a personal level and as an organisation, which I think is incredible. But just following on from Gail, what you were saying about communities I think often in this question, we forget about audiences. And I think that's the thing, like, it's going, actually, how do audiences, who when we imagine this audience, this when often what happens, it's only related to specific shows or specific programs or specific strand of, you know, funding programs. It's never part of the mainstream audience. We're always on the margins.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, because I started in participation work and in community engagement, and for me, like, my heart will always be there. And I was just exhausted after 15 years. I was like, how are we having the same conversation? Mm. How, like, I've seen generations come through, and I think we only imagine those communities in a particular way, and their relationship is very limited. I'm not disregarding the work. I think there's an absolute power and importance to having creative programs, you know, bringing the art and all of those things, but we seem to have put these kind of these ceilings to, like, what else that relationship can be. And for somebody who came from a hard to reach area, I don't know if that term still gets used, but it was,
it
like
does.
Yeah, is it like hard? And I was like,
what does that
wow
mean?
But I can only be imagined as. And my peers could only be imagined as a participant in a 3-month program, doing a workshop and imparting creativity. Because before then, I had no creativity in my life at all. Of course, because that's hard to imagine, right? Mm. But we're never imagined as leaders, directors, or whatever that is. We're only seen in a particular way. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in that area of work as well. And I think the marriage between. And I think this is more in institutions and venue and non-venue, when they are planning their programs of work, there needs to be alignment between the participation engagement work and what they're programming and the artists. Mm-hmm. And it needs to stop being solely on artists to bring their audiences in.
Mm-hmm.
That is not audience development. Let the artists be artists and do the thing that they want to do and grow and bloom and fail and all those beautiful things, not... Are we going to program you because you're going to bring 100 X amount of people from that community? That's
And then we'll never talk to them again.
Yeah.
Until 2 years later when we have something else that looks a bit like that show that you came with.
And we'll use the pictures for the next 4 years, please.
Yeah. Of course.
Yes.
I totally
agree with everything you're saying, Serena. There's a venue near to me that's recently opened up in terms of, like, what that leadership could look like. And I think... something that excites me is the idea of going, yeah, not one artistic director, but actually going somebody like a kind of a committee of people who are all like heads of all of the departments, almost, of like new work and community and youth, and sort of why should there not be a committee of these? Obviously, there are loads of other more radical versions, but when you see the rest of the structure is most likely going to remain the same, I guess these small little changes can start to chip away at maybe the bigger question and the bigger solutions.
I think we also need to diversify our funding streams and sponsorship. It's like, and I think this is when it's quite interesting when looking at engagement with global majority communities. They're often pigeonholed into communities that are deprived or underserved, which there's truth in that, but we're never seen as going actually where there's also affluent global majority communities and businesses, right, who want to invest back into the community, who have a relationship to art and culture.
Totally agree with that.
I'm really interested then, if you, so yeah, they're all really gorgeous thoughts, and my next question is about building teams. When you have in the past built teams around you, how do you build teams that align with your vision and values, some of the values that we have just talked about, for example?
I mean, part of it, if you're working with different people, part of it is luck, because you never know until you work with someone actually whether you're going to gel, or whether the things that you've been looking for in that initial chat and that they've said, whether they actually feel true in practice when you work with them. But I look for... I don't really try and find people to align with my vision, because I feel like as director anyway, my vision grows when there are a wider range of people to counter it. So I don't really look for that, but I do look for values. And I think that collaboration is something we talk about all the time, but theatre is a collaborative art form. I think it's incredibly hard to do well. And so I look for people who I think will be able to do that. And for me, that's about care for the art and care for the people that we're working with. It's about what's really hard is emotional containment. Theatre is stressful. And it's vulnerable, and it makes us scared a lot of the times at varying different points along the process, especially as we get more tired and we start doing 12-hour days for no real reason. But I look for people in those situations who can feel that fear, feel vulnerable, feel activated in different ways, and can hold on to their emotion and not spill onto others. Or who can be really honest and open about how they're feeling and just go, I'm terrified, sorry, maybe I'm going to be like communicating a little jankily today. Okay, that's fine. We can then I know that, and I can tell you what I'm coming with, and we can still care for each other and care for the art. So, yeah, I look for care. I look for responsibility. I look for people who can say, oh, I really don't know how to do that. And I look for people who are curious and who want to play. And who go, oh, I don't know. Like, I literally don't know. Let's see. Let's try this. I try to gamify a lot of things. So I look for people who are up for playing, for creating, for taking risks.
I'd agree with a lot of what you said there, Gail. Because I think it is... also, you don't know how you're going to be in that process as well. And I think it's having... I think care, communication. I think also for them to be excited by like what that kernel of that story is, to come back to that, like, but when it comes to like building a team, it's going, actually, are you excited by what we're making? And whether that's a play, whether that's a community project, whether that, whatever that might be, I think you need to, I need to know that they're rooting for it as much as I am. In that conversation, going, actually, how self-aware they are. Is for me is, and it's not about having all the answers or anything, but just going, actually, can we communicate, can we have a dialogue? And I know that's not always possible in that initial conversation, and as you said, like, especially new relationships, kind of trust my gut as well. I think that's really important in going, actually, can we, and that could be just a few phrases here or there, like there's just something in going, actually, okay, we want to invest in building this relationship together. It's so funny because I recently just built a team together. And I'm like, what was I looking for? What was it?
It's also interesting because it's also having the time and space to like think about your practice like that. Because I don't know about you, because the hustle and bustle is so fast sometimes, I never get a chance to stop and reflect.
Yeah.
And sometimes questions like this start on me because I'm like, do I even think when I'm building teams? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because between building a team that sort of happens in and amongst emails when you're freelancing for three other companies or whatever, sometimes it's hard to take the space and time. But actually on reflection, I think I need to take some more space and time and not be rushed in that thing of like, okay, we need an answer for who you want the sound design to be. Yeah. Can you get this back to me in 24 hours because we need to send out AV checks? And then you're like, shit, what do I do? And then you're mad Googling, mad ringing people, who's available. And then, especially when you're working in the north as well, and rightly so, it's like, this is your geography of where the radius can go out to. So then the pool becomes smaller. It's difficult.
Yeah. I think a couple of things that I've, like, in recent years have started asking is, like, what their practice is in those early conversations, like, as a given, and also sharing what my practice is, how I perceive it anyway. One could argue going, you liar! and how they speak about... I think it's more of that... Because I think two things happen when you ask that question of... even though their practice might be completely like going actually weird pulls apart, which I think isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's something that they are then aware of, going actually this is how I work, these are the things that I value. There's an awareness of it. Whereas I think, you know, people I've met whose work I've seen and it's brilliant, but when I've asked them that question, they're like, oh, I just do. And I'm like, for me, that I think, yeah. It didn't quite work on a personal level. And I think the other thing is also like about how I also ask them like how do they best work and what they need from me and what they need from others in the room. And I think then that informs what you're saying around that care, right? Like it's all interconnected because I don't think you can care and curate a space if you don't know, especially, you know, you've got a team of six people and there's conflicting needs and which is cool, but you go actually how do we navigate that?
I mean, really interested of like how have you both how have you reached this point of where you feel really sure of like, okay, this is actually how I build the team, this is my process, how has that evolved over like time, like what did you learn from and how has it shaped?
For me, I remember when I loved my uni course, like it opened my world at University of Huddersfield, shout out. what year did I graduate? Class of 2008. I just had some mint lecturers who, like their practice just really opened my world of going actually, not just in terms of making theatre, but how you make it, all of those things. And then after I'd graduated, I became really interested in practice because I felt like as theatre makers and especially actors because I did a little bit of performing at the time as all directors do at some point there was this thing about like I was like actually every other art form like writers write, musicians play, like, but theatre maker, like where do we practice if it's only when we've got the gig, like only when we've got the job, when do we get to train and practice? And then I started working with a company called Obra Theatre, another shout out, absolute legends, based in south of France. And they started hosting these residencies. And I was really intrigued about how do you build ensembles? How do you find play? How do you create flow? And those questions, I think, were sparked from me while I was like studying. And I was like, oh, actually, I've never thought of that in relation to theatre making. So I think that inquiry has stayed with me for the last, like, I don't know, 20 years. So it's going, actually, what are the tools to build that play, safe environment? And in all honesty, Beth, I think for me, like, I know I do my best work in that environment. And then I've just been really fortunate over the years to work with some brilliant individuals and organisations and then some not so brilliant. And that also has informed my learning of going, oh, I definitely don't want to be in that kind of room again. Mm. What do I need to not do?
We're still figuring it out.
Every
project you learn something new. Every project I learn something more about the way that I like to work and the way that I don't like to work and the way that how I show up in the room affects other people. Mm. But if we're shouting out universities, let's shout out the University of Hull, another Yorkshire-based one. Because, it was a really collaborative degree. It had collaboration at the heart of it. And a real respect for all of the different departments that go together to... You can't just be a director and not know how to talk to a lighting designer, or a lighting designer who doesn't know how to talk to a sound designer. There was a real emphasis on understanding enough about each discipline within theatre to communicate properly. So I think that's where it started. But for me, I'm a facilitator first. Mm. So my work has been about telling stories, using stories with professional artists, yes, but also people who would never call themselves artists, people who might happen to be five, people who might be, you know, elders or mental health service users. And so I think the very particular form of care that is often structured in participatory or community-based work I just then carry into professional work, because we're being paid, why shouldn't we take care of each other as well in those sorts of settings? So I think of myself as a facilitator. Mm-hmm. And actually, Bryony Shanahan, I was working with a couple of weeks ago, and she said a really similar thing. She was just like, a director isn't a specialist in anything.
Yeah.
We're generalists, and actually our job is to provide the space for every other person on that team to do their best work. And I think that's stuck in my head, because it was just a recent thing that someone said that I chimed with.
Yeah,
and I was
really
like,
cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
Shall we sidestep? We've heard Hull. Is it Huddersfield?
It was.
We've heard Halifax. We've heard all these amazing cities around the country. So our next question on that theme is, should it matter where you live and make work?
I don't think this question's for the Londoner in the room, so I'm going to step back.
Do you know, when I saw that question, I was like, oh, man, should it matter where... Say it again, Beth. Because I kept on reading it over and over again.
So I suppose what it's asking, I think it's about what does it mean to be like an artist outside of London, or to be an artist in London making work elsewhere. There's been sort of, I guess, a push in the last ACE round to move work outside of London. Where you are rooted, where you are based, how does that affect your ability to sort of make work, progress as an artist, all of these sorts of things?
Cool. Should it matter? No, it shouldn't, but it does. Like, I think that's how I feel. Like, in terms of how the industry works, how individuals, organisations, all of that, I think this whole London v regions is just such a ridiculous, like, it's just bonkers. Like, I find that just so, aside from, like, and I'm not talking about where the funds sit, I'm just talking about even attitude to, and the conversation in the regions when you're from a region to region, it's a different conversation. But I could be based in London, have not done any work for 9 months, and it's like, great, you're doing well because I'm in London, right? And I could have been working 18 months, projects back to back, all over Yorkshire. And it's like, but you've not made it until you've got a credit in London. So, and I think that's not, and that isn't about the work or the individuals you're working with, or artists, but that's just the optics of that. And that I find really just like disrespectful, outrageous, and disgusting. Mm-hmm. I really do. Like,
just for absolute clarity, whose optics are they? Who's saying that?
That is, I think that's the industry's optics and individual. Like, I think, again, there's this misconception that that's what success looks like, whether you're good at your job. Mm. And I think I remember when I graduated from uni, and everyone's advice was to move to London. And naively at the time, I was like, I'm never leaving Halifax, because I was like, if we're always uprooting, the work will never get made. Mm. And then that kind of, like, and I know the irony that I'm really excited to be working on this show in London, just to say. But 20 years
while
later,
we're sat in London.
I know. So the irony doesn't miss me. But I think it's, again, like, who can afford to... It just places so many barriers, even, and I've seen it with artists who are amazing, incredible, talented, but like feel like they haven't either made it or they're not good enough or all of those things just because there's not a credit or an attachment to some London-based organisation. There's some really deep-rooted underestimation of communities, of artists that are outside of London. And I think then that is, like, I just find it, also I just think it's just really boring.
Yes. And I also think there's power between us as artists, and especially like as another artist up north, like I've experienced that actually a lot from people down here, leaders down here. I've worked for their theatres who've said stuff to me like, no one knows who you are down here, but you're actually really great. You should work down here more and you'd get more jobs. And then I would say to them, I'm actually really happy, thank you. I've got quite a lot of gigs up north, touch wood. I'm quite happy doing my thing. I come down to London for specific projects and stories that I'm interested in, but I'm quite happy. It's that saviour thing of like, we can actually discover you down here. And actually, I don't need to be discovered. I don't want to be discovered. I just want to like make shows, do good stories, go home, pay my bills, see my wife. That's what I want to do. Mm. And that excellence thing as well. I also see it in reviews, and like I'm self-represented but have recently thought about agents and stuff, but when you invite them to shows anywhere above like, well yeah, basically London, no one wants to come. There's also, I've worked recently in a couple of drama schools up north in Liverpool, and I went to go watch a graduate showcase a couple of weeks ago. And everybody, I was like, oh, you guys are like excited to graduate? They're like, yeah, we're moving to London. I was like, oh, right, okay, cool. Next person, yeah, I'm moving to London. Everybody, I would say like 95% of that year group is moving to London to make it. And the amount of conversations I had, it was just a copy and paste conversation being like, guys, you should stay in Liverpool. It's it's really rich in the Northwest. There's so much going on. There's so many theatres in Manchester alone. I'm always looking for actors that are based within this region. And I also feel, as a director, it's sad for me because there's so many gorgeous local artists, designers, actors, directors who are moving to London, and I feel like I can't access them because, well, because we can't afford it. We can't afford to bring, and nor should we bring up people from London also, but I think it's something, it's the power of language, it's the power, it's what we give to our graduates, it's what we give to our peers by going, oh, you have a gig at the National, that's amazing. Mm. Oh, you have a gig at Sheffield, that's cool. Mm. It's like, actually, no, it's all cool. What's the story? That's the most important thing. So I think there's also power in language between us as well.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. But I think the flip of that, so like if you're a London-based creative or actor, doing something in the regions, it's like well, thank you very much, you know, it's almost like that elevates the status. London-based X, Y and Z coming to poor little Leeds and Sheffield. Do you know what I mean? That's how I read it. I don't know, but
it'd be interesting to hear from Gail.
No, it'd be interesting to hear from Gail.
Sorry, my bad. I know that we were just speaking about you've been working
Work in the Midlands at the moment, and It's just really interesting because I've been looking at Birmingham from the outside for the last 15 years or so, just going, my word, like the community of black artists that exist there, the work that is happening there is phenomenal. It's not just the work, but it's the community of artists is stronger than the community of artists in London, that they are inspiring each other and working with each other and testing each other and making work and growing in ways that we can't in London. Because it's we're so fragmented, because there are so many of us, and we're all constantly in competition with each other, I think. But I think there's a real collaboration that I have been seeing in Birmingham for ages, and I've had a few invitations over the last 18 months or so, which means I'm doing a lot of work in Birmingham, and I'm doing some work in Coventry as well. And I'm constantly having conversations going, should I be here? Do you want me to leave? Should someone else actually be having this role? So, yeah, it makes me feel slightly gross inside. Just the idea of me just going, oh, here I am to give you credit and status, because that's not how I'm approaching it. No, I know. But also from the outside, those are the optics, and if that's the power dynamic, which it is, then I have to be aware of that and I have to move against that. I have to actively counter it. But yes, I don't know. I think from my perspective, there is a richness in specific local mm-hmm. work. There's a richness in us making work for the people around us, whether that's, whether we're talking about race, whether we're talking about locality, whatever community mm-hmm. it is that we're from and that we're interested in, that I think we should be making from our own cultural context, from that basis and for those people. That's what I try to do in all of my work. So, yeah, the exodus. London's cool. I'm a Londoner. I grew up here. I'm always going to shout for it, right? But I would really encourage anyone who has the opportunity to be home and to create from home and to build not just a project or a story or a play, but to build an infrastructure that allows artists to be creating work around, in and of home. I'd humbly say, do it. And if I get the opportunity to collaborate with you on it, great. But also, if you want me to stay away, then tell me. Yeah. Tell me happily.
Yeah. And I think... I was going to say, just building on that, because I live in Birmingham. I'm not from Birmingham, but I live in Birmingham. Been there for like the last 12 years. And I totally agree on that idea of that sense of community that is there. And actually, when I did go to London for a year when I was like 21 or 22, and I came back and did the Foundry at the Rep and Tessa Walker was sort of leading it at that time, and I sort of relayed to her this comment that a director that that was like leading a company that I'd worked with in London was like, yeah, you'd like, it's dead outside of London, like there's no point making work anywhere else and you're not going to progress. And Tessa was like, absolutely not, like you're going to progress quicker because of that sense of community, because of like you can make work in a very different way. I think outside of London is when you're in London, it's often like a scrabble and that competition is so fierce in London that actually landing in somewhere like Birmingham, I've been able to, like at least at around that time of the Foundry especially, like try and fail more than I feel like maybe sometimes the pressure when you're in London is like it has to be perfect all the time because there's so many eyes on me. But yeah, I don't know, I've really enjoyed the space and the community that I've found in Birmingham.
Yeah. I think just to add to that, like for me, I think there's such beauty and power and strength in that concept of home, like working from, and I don't mean your literal home, but where you feel safe and where you feel at home and where you know your community is just whatever community that is, you're safe, that circle that you're connected to. Because then no matter what happens in that day-to-day stuff, you're just arm's reach from that community and that home and that safety. And I think sometimes we don't ask that question, especially I think as a young artist, maybe there's so much pressure that's being put on oneself, but there's that will inform your work. Like, you know, maybe I'm jumping a question, but like, but you know, like I know that the reason my career and the way that I work and all of those things are my practice, yes, it's been because of the projects and the people and organisations, all of them, but ultimately it's because of my network at home and my community, because they've challenged me and questioned me and nourished me and all of those things. I can guarantee you I would not be here. Like I would not have had the career that I had if it wasn't for my family. And I think it is, and that's not because there's that literal support, but it's just that belief that they have in you and just feeling safe, because our industry is not safe. Like, this country is not safe. Mm-hmm. So those pockets of safety are far and few in between. So, it's. I think it's really important to recognise that, okay, and actually, when are we placing ourselves in places of harm?
Yeah. And just to jump on that sort of... The other thing that I see happening outside of London that inspires me and or that I'm slightly jealous of is... creatives are able to speak interdisciplinarily more. So that the unsafety of the country, the unsafety of our industry is, there's an ability to challenge that and to build something slightly new if artists are talking to architects, are talking to educators, are talking to activists. And that, again, this is me. This is my love affair with Birmingham, it seems. But yes, yeah, really beautiful work happening up there.
Fabulous.
I wonder if we could move on to our next question, which you kind of... You were talking there, Samina, about safety and our industry not necessarily being safe. How do you hope that the industry will evolve over the next decade in terms of inclusivity and representation, or also just generally? How do you want it to evolve?
I hope we're not using those words anymore.
Mm-hmm. Evolve.
Inclusivity.
Mm-mm-mm. Nice.
Representation.
Nice. Mm-mm-mm.
They like proper hurt, you know, like little pricks. But all of those words, I've been doing a lot of reflecting. This year has been a lot of reflection going on, and I'm like, I find them like inclusivity, diversity, like, and I work within that, and I think, you have to use, you know, I have to use them because I'm like, okay, this is the shared language that we have. So I would hope that our language evolves.
Yeah, if our language has shifted, then theoretically so have our, so is our thinking. Mm.
Yeah. Like, I remember a time when representation and inclusivity wasn't a thing. It was a thing, but we didn't have that language. That wasn't used or it wasn't on the map. And you're seeing artists coming through who are seeing themselves through that lens and that filter.
As in, like, they see themselves as, like, an inclusivity hire.
Or diversity hire.
Yeah.
I've had conversations with artists, bless them. I'm not going to name them. But, like, you know, really honest comments. They were like, I've got no trauma. I've got a good life. Like, do you know what I mean? They're like, And then, you know, and I remember a piece of work that this came. I was like, why are you doing this? I was like, I don't know, I need to write a piece about the partition because that's going to be the thing. Do you know what I mean? Or I need to dig deep and find some deep-rooted trauma because that's what sells. And then I think that's interesting of going, actually, and where's that come from? That's what we're telling our artists, that actually pain sells, trauma sells. This, you know, and how do we free ourselves from the white gaze?
And interesting, you know, how are we telling our new generation of artists those things, do you think? Is it, like, not just through the words that we use, but I guess through the work that's platformed? And
I don't know, maybe it's a mix. I think maybe it's also in terms of how we're wanting to program or commission work. Like, I'm seeing a wave of work that's happening on the underground, which isn't mainstream, isn't attached to any institution. It's happening completely grassroots level. And it's mint. It's exciting. Mm. They're actually completely... They're like, I'll do my day job and I'll make my music and I'll make my art and we'll gather around and we'll support each other. You know, it's happening without... And then you're like, but you should be getting paid. And then it's like... I've had to check myself and I'm like, actually, they feel satisfied as an artist. They feel nourished. They've got a community. They've got an audience. Who am I to tell them to go apply for an ACE project or go to X, Y and Z? Because that's my conditioning.
I think we talked about it on the last episode with... the wonderful Rani Murthy about global majority artists feeling the need to educate white people in their work and whether they're doing it intentionally or unintentionally, it almost somehow finds a way into work. And actually, for me, even with this programme, like, I would not have to like to be, I would like to not have to be a brown woman trying to imagine this programme, work with theatres, work with white leaders, work with white organisations to evolve the industry. In fact, I would like more white leaders, white artists to step up, start unconditioning, start doing the work and start to educate their fellow white peers so that we can just be artists and spend time on telling stories and evolve our practice. That's what I would hope for.
I've got one more, which I guess it's for global majority artists, creatives, all of that. Stop blaming our elders. That I'm not saying stuff doesn't go on and we all have our... But proper gets my goat when people go, actually, I couldn't do X, Y and Z because my parents or my grandparents didn't think the arts... And I'm like, mate, they were right. Like, why would they want... It wasn't because they don't care about the arts or they don't believe in storytelling or all of those things. They know how hostile this environment is.
I can't say I wholeheartedly want the kids in my life to go into the arts.
You know?
It's hard. It's a hard life. It's hostile. It's precarious. You're not eating. You're not... All of those things. I can't say. So maybe some of that... that people can comfortably, all of us can comfortably make work and eat.
Yeah.
And that there's freedom in that, that you were just talking about, that sort of freedom just to make whatever you want in the way that you want it without apologising or explaining to others. And that there's, and care, I'm just thinking about a company that does interesting creative work, that use creativity in community settings with kids that are in different varieties of crisis. So either the precarious citizenship status or long-term sick in hospital, all of those sorts of things. And just the way that this company has threaded therapeutic practice and supervision through their organisation is really exciting as well. So they're taking care of their freelancers, but their artistic director and their executive director have regular therapy sessions together as well. So it's just like, so we're actually thinking about how we're working together, not just what we're doing and how we're supporting each other. So yeah, that sort of,
that's really cool.
Idea of care and that understanding of trauma, I would also really hope to thread through the entire industry. Because we've all, we are all carrying different traumas, both personal ones, but also collective ones from this very particular world that we live in.
Yeah. So for me, in terms of maybe one thing that I'd like to see evolve is companies that are doing, already doing really radical things in terms of how they work. And I'd like more space and time for those companies to also share their practice so that we can, learn. Because I think so often, they're often smaller companies and are sort of stuck in loops of just trying to get funding for the next project.
I think for institutions that want to do work on inclusivity and representation, for their budgets to reflect that work, like when they program work, whether it's a year, 3 year, 3 months, whatever the timeline is, if they could have a look at their budgets, not how many people they've engaged, not how many artists, how much of their budget, percentage of their budget is going on inclusion and representation, and then make a call.
And if we're not satisfied, then the money gets taken away. I'm a big fan of defunding.
Lovely. Great. We're up on time. I'm so sorry. I could chat all day.
It has been really wonderful chat with some big questions, but I think we've also got some big answers as well, which is exciting. So thank you everyone for listening.
If you love this episode, then please do share it with your friends and maybe even leave a cheeky review.
And for more of Tell Them, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on our socials for episode drops. Next week, we'll be chatting with Justine Taman and Kimber Lee.